From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Are you a sellout?
When you don't sell out in politics and the public, namely the voters, don't do their homework about the actual record of different candidates and simply go for one of the two major parties and ignore a third party candidate, you don't get many votes. So you pay a price.
If that's what selling out looks like, buying a lobbyist, hiring a lawyer, getting airtime, I think it's probably an effective way to change people's minds or at least to get exposure. I'm all for it.
You know, I look at the concept of a sellout being compromising your integrity to pander to the lowest common denominator purely for commercial purposes. I've been able to succeed despite of my unwillingness to compromise what I do.
I just got sent to Washington a year ago as part of this revolution. I know eventually there's going to have to be a resolution that could be 4, 6, 8, 10 years down the road, but now's not the time for me to reach across the aisle.
There are songs that you wrote when you were 18, 19, 20. They don't resonate the same way when you have a kid and when you have a song called F Authority, but you're, you know, trying to tell your kids to eat their vegetables, it becomes kind of hypocritical, to say the least.
So what about you? Are you a sellout? And you're not the only one we're asking today. We'll talk with protesters at Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party, also punk rock dads, graffiti artists, and even Ralph Nader. Love him or hate him, presidential candidate and consumer advocate Ralph Nader is a man who has stuck to his principles. Since the 1960s, he's been responsible for numerous federal consumer protection laws, including the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and the Freedom of Information Act. He also helped create OSHA, the EPA, and the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration. Steve Paulson spoke with Ralph Nader about living a principled life.
You have been called a lot of things, hero, gadfly, spoiler, but you have never been called a sellout. So I'm wondering, when you look back at your life and your career, how important has it been to you not to sell out?
Well, when you're raised in that way, there's really no alternative. So unlike Oscar Wilde, who once said he can resist everything but temptation, I was raised to resist temptation. So my mother and father and three older siblings, all by their own example and by what they read and what they conversed, basically conveyed to me that there is no alternative other than to tell the truth, because the truth reflects reality and it avoids delusion. And if you reflect reality, you can convey how to improve reality. And that's what I applied to the auto safety movement in the 1960s, that selling out by so many people who knew how unsafe these autos were designed was because their livelihood was at stake. They were employed by General Motors or Chrysler or Ford or VW. Or if they're at universities, they might lose some grants or not be promoted. And so when I looked at the situation, I knew that it wasn't all due to the driver, that the highway and the motor vehicle had a very important connection in first reducing the likelihood of collisions and second reducing the likelihood of injuries or fatalities when the collision occurred. So you see, connecting with reality by not selling out allowed me to propose ways to make cars safer, which Congress adopted in the motor vehicle and highway safety laws of 1965 and 66, signed by President Lyndon Johnson.
Mm-hmm. But you live and work in a political world. You, of course, have been a presidential candidate. How have you survived a career in politics without compromise, without selling out? Because we always hear politics is the art of compromise.
When you don't sell out in politics and the public, namely the voters, don't do their homework about the actual record of different candidates and simply go for one of the two major parties and ignore a third party candidate, you don't get many votes. So you pay a price.
And you have paid that price?
Yes. Well, I didn't get many votes, even though majority of the people wanted me on the presidential debates and by number of polls. And certainly my agenda was a majoritarian agenda. If you polled it, most people want full Medicare for all with free choice of doctor and hospital. They want law enforcement to be tough on corporate crime, fraud, and abuse against consumers and workers and the environment, and on. But it didn't make any difference, because once the two-party system has, in effect, a joint dictatorship keeping other candidate choices from reaching the voters, it's very easy for them to proceed in that kind of tight environment and not tell so much the truth and still prevail.
But I guess the question is, would you be more effective, or would more of your agenda get on to the sort of the public, into the public conversation, if you were willing to compromise more?
Well, that word compromise has to be taken in the following way. I don't have to compromise, because let's say I'm up against General Motors or Exxon or Pfizer. They're so powerful on Capitol Hill, they force a compromise. So why should I help them do it? So it's really like a tug of war. And, you know, if you're on one end of the tug, you don't give the opponent a slack. The opponent is going to try to pull you. So in that sense, our proposals, which I have always thought understated the need, they're quite reasonable, were sandpapered down by the opposition in the House and Senate, for example, by the corporate lobbies.
So what you're saying is that, I mean, you've sort of held to, a certain degree of purity. I mean, you've said, okay, here's what we need to do. Here are my principles, and you just push as hard as you can on those, and you figure that, well, as these get taken into the political system, they will. Other people will compromise then?
They'll compromise my position, because when I support a safety goal, I feel that I'm the volunteer trustee for millions of people out there who need to have a safer workplace, cleaner air, cleaner water, safer food, and so forth. And it's not up to me to decide for them how weak I'm going to make what I believe to be a reasonable case. So we'll leave it up to the opposition and in the context of Capitol Hill.
Do you see yourself as representing the citizen?
Yeah, very much so. That's what a public citizen does. Going back to ancient Athens, when they had people going around the city, improving the city, and day after day, and they called them public citizens. And that's a trusteeship on behalf of people who are busy with other things.
Well, I want to take you back to the fall of 2008, right after Barack Obama was elected president, because you made a statement that got a lot of public attention, got you into a lot of hot water. You said, and I'm quoting here, "To put it very simply, Obama is our first African-American president, or he will be, and we wish him well, but his choice basically is whether he's going to be Uncle Sam for the people of this country or Uncle Tom for the giant corporations." That didn't go over very well for a lot of people who just voted for Obama. Of course, that was then, and this is now. And I guess I'm wondering how folks on the left are responding to your critique of Obama now.
Well, they're very critical of Obama, and a lot of them have said that I read him right, that he was basically very good rhetorically, but he signaled again and again by wanting to keep a large military budget, expand the war in Afghanistan, not go for full Medicare for all, and be rather concessionary to Wall Street and the prolonged bailouts that he inherited from George W. Bush, that he was really very much of a corporatist pragmatically, however he might have appeared on the stump rhetorically.
Are you saying Obama has sold out?
Well, he sold out almost in the dictionary sense, in the sense that, you know, about a third of the money he's raised, and he's raised about $150 million so far, a record at this time, on his way to a billion, from the financial industry, otherwise known as Wall Street. And it's pretty tough, you know, to pursue a people's agenda, which often comes into conflict with corporate priorities and demands and avariciousness, and have your hand out through your emissaries in posh Manhattan restaurants or in Beverly Hills, California, raising money from corporate interests.
Now, there's been a pretty interesting alliance that's popped up in just the last year or so. I know you have joined with a Tea Party favorite, Ron Paul, to to form a kind of progressive libertarian alliance. Can you tell me about that?
Well, you see, the pure libertarians don't sell out either. You may disagree with them, but they don't have antenna calculating how this is going to affect sales or their promotion or the approbation of their peers. And Ron Paul is in that category. Now, I disagree with him very fundamentally in his position against all health and safety regulation, all Medicare, Medicaid. But on foreign and military policy, I think he's right on. I think his criticism of the Patriot Act and degrading our civil liberties is right on. I think his criticism of the sovereignty-shredding, job-exporting NAFTA and the World Trade Organization is right on. I think he does want strict law enforcement on corporate criminals and fraud. And I think he likes to keep the courts open for people who have grievances and not engage in restricting our tort law. And so the question is, well, why not, without having to compromise our respective positions, why not collaborate? And I think we're going to see an increasing convergence between libertarian and authentic conservatives and liberal and authentic progressives on more and more of these issues. Whether it can turn into a political force or a political party, that remains to be seen.
So how are progressives responding to your overtures to the Tea Party?
Well, when I talk about the agenda, they can't disagree because they're on the same side as Ron Paul. I mean, when Ron Paul says, what are we doing becoming an American empire with bases in over 100 countries, spending tens of billions of dollars on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, spreading into Yemen and Libya and elsewhere, without even a congressional declaration of law? He's a strict constitutionalist. And a lot of progressives agree with that.
Suppose a truly progressive Democratic president were elected and appointed you to, let's say, a cabinet position, and you were in the position where you really could advance your agenda more, but you would have to compromise. You would have to sell out to some degree. Would that trade-off be worth it?
Well, first of all, compromise doesn't mean selling out. I mean, selling out usually means return of some material or honorific reward. As, let's say, as Attorney General, you have to compromise in terms of not going over the due process violation. You can't throw people in jail without charges, deny them access to lawyers, as has been happening, wiretap them without judicial approval, which is a serious felony under federal law. So you got to make sure that with the enormous authority that's in an attorney general, that you restrain yourself in that sense. So procedurally, you got to restrain yourself. Substantively, you are an advocate as an attorney general, and you can take the facts as far as they'll go with you.
Sounds like if the attorney general job were offered to you, you'd say, sure, I'll take it.
It has to be the right president, because you're the attorney general for the president, unfortunately, even though legally you're representing the people of the United States.
Presidential candidate and consumer advocate Ralph Nader. Steve Paulson spoke with him from his office in D.C. Freshman Representative Joe Walsh is a Republican serving the 8th District of Illinois, and he's a member of the Tea Party caucus. Walsh says not only will he never sell out, he won't even compromise. In fact, Walsh is considered the unofficial spokesman for the no-compromise faction of the Republican majority in the U.S. House. I was curious, isn't politics the art of compromise?
Yes, and eventually you're right. To get anything done, to move the goal at all, you do need to compromise. You need to bring more people under your tent, into your view. But I take a longer view right now. Eventually, there's going to need to be compromise to get things done. But the argument that I try to make is not right now. Right now, we were sent to try to, if you will, repeal much of what the president's done. And if that can't be done, at least stop a lot of what he's done. The differences are so great with what he believes in most Democrats and with what most Republicans believe, that I think we'd be poorly served if we compromised any time in this next year. It's too early.
I'm curious, I guess, to know whether you see a difference between sticking to your principles, which I understand you to be saying, mm-hmm. and, well, just being stubborn.
No, I guess I'd say it's more strategic. I believe the country right now is going through a revolution, all right? Nobody's shooting each other. But we're going through a war, really arguing about and debating about our founding principles. And I would argue that the war began when President Obama got elected. And so we're very early in this revolution. And by the way, I think the revolution's a great thing because we've put off these questions for a long time. So here we are now 2 to 3 years into this revolution. I just got sent to Washington a year ago as part of this revolution. I know eventually there's going to have to be a resolution that could be 4, 6, 8, 10 years down the road. But now's not the time for me to reach across the aisle.
So you think that the people who disagree with you are simply wrong?
I think in the main they're dead wrong. In general. And Jim, that's what's actually so fascinating about what we're going through right now is that, look, it's President Obama didn't get us here alone. You know, Republicans and Democrats for years have grown this government to the point where we are now broke, and we are now more broke than anyone knows. Shame on both parties for doing that. This president has taken it to a new dangerous extreme. So, yes, that's wrong, and that needs to be stopped.
Again, there are so many different ways in which we can talk about this. Mm-hmm. One of the things about negotiation, frankly, when I was raised in Illinois, not that far from the district that you represent.
Okay.
When I was growing up, my mother told me that calling someone a liar was not a nice thing to do. But you have very famously... I just watched a video that you posted on YouTube, which it begins with you saying, President Obama, stop lying to the American people. That's a very strong statement.
It was, because it was, in my mind, a very strong statement he made when he told the American people, if August 2nd comes and goes and we don't raise the debt ceiling, boy, I can't guarantee that seniors are going to get their Social Security checks. I believe at that time he knew that wasn't an accurate statement. I believed at that time that he was simply saying that to try to scare senior citizens. Now, again, I've been very careful, Jim, maybe not always, but in not calling him a liar because I don't know the president. In that instance, I certainly felt like he was lying to the American people. Look, I've been pretty direct with this president, and I'm just a freshman in Congress. I simply believe that he's in over his head. I think we elected him based on who he was. He was a historic figure. We knew very little about him, and we certainly didn't know necessarily what he was going to do. We now know after 2 or 3 years, I think, what he aims to do. And much of what he's doing is really hurting this country badly.
You know, the Republican Party in general, and the Tea Party specifically, has been labeled by Democrats, at least, as the party of no. How do you respond to that?
Well, two things. I believe that this thing we call the Tea Party movement, I believe it's bigger than either party. And I've been saying this for a couple of years now. I don't think the media has any clue as to how big this movement is. And truthfully, I don't think my Republican Party understands it or the Democratic Party. So to me, it's the silent growing majority. But having said that, no, I think it's the exact opposite. I think the Tea Party is the party of yes. The Tea Party, Jim, basically stands for a much more limited government, so we get government out of the way, we get to keep more of our own money, and we're responsible for more of our own lives. Now, to me, that's an optimistic view. That's a view that says, if you let me keep more of the dollar I make, I'll grow my business. I'll take care of my family. I'll take care of my parents as they get older. I'll be in charge of my own health care. I'll take care of the poor people in the community in which I live. That's the party of yes. To me, the Democratic Party, the party that believes in bigger government, that only government, that government needs to force people to do things, that's a very pessimistic view of mankind. That tells me that, that we need to, that's a party that says we need to take more of your money so that we can solve the world's problems because you're not good enough or smart enough to do it on your own. We need government to provide your health care for you because you're not smart enough to go out there and shop for your own health care. So I guess I always argue we're the party of yes, we're the optimistic party.
Earlier this year, the candidate for president, Ron Paul, who is often seen as a favorite of the Tea Party, aligned with the progressive Ralph Nader on what they called a progressive libertarian alliance. Do you think such a thing is possible?
Without knowing the specifics, my answer would be no, not at all. I mean, again, there's clearly a libertarian strand throughout the Tea Party movement, which means limited government and more freedom. And the progressive viewpoint is the exact opposite. The progressive viewpoint, again, respectfully, just believes in a larger, more activist government to solve our country's problems. I don't know how you can reconcile at all those two viewpoints.
It's also curious that we've seen in the national press that the Tea Party, as represented there certainly, did not feel that the Occupy Wall Street people had anything in common with them. They appear to in that both object to government as it is. Do you think it's just a cultural difference that causes the split between the two, the disparity between the two, or is there something more?
No, I think they have nothing, if not very, very, very little in common. Look, again, I think the Tea Party movement is a real movement. It's an organic movement, whether the media wants to accept that or not. This Occupy Wall Street stuff, this isn't a movement. This is a series of well-orchestrated protests. And what these two sides stand for and believe in, again, are diametrically opposed. The Tea Party movement believes in much more limited government and much more freedom and accountability for all of us out here. We don't look toward big government to solve our problems. When you look at the Occupy Wall Street protesters are advocating, you know, like many far left progressives, again, respectfully, they're advocating big government solutions, which is anathema to what I think, well, it's anathema to what the vast majority of this country believes in.
Freshman Representative Joe Walsh is a Republican serving the 8th District of Illinois, and he's a member of the Tea Party Caucus. He's the unofficial spokesman for the no-compromise faction of the Republican majority in the U.S. House. Ralph Nader thinks the Tea Party and the Occupy Wall Street movements should work together. Congressman Joe Walsh clearly does not. We were curious what the Occupy Wall Street folks think. Could they see themselves working with the Tea Party? So we sent reporter Sarah Kate Kramer to New York City to ask them.
The Tea Party thinks that the government has too much control, and OWS thinks that the corporations have too much control. And I think that the government and the corporation are the same thing, and they have too much control. So yeah, I would work with somebody from the Tea Party. If they have the same goal as I do, yeah, absolutely.
I would love to see a reform of the banking system. However, the idea of partnering with the Tea Party makes my heart cringe. I've heard some of the horrific things that a lot of their key spokesmen and leaders have said, and a lot of the things that they have said have gone completely against what we believe in.
I absolutely would not support working with the Tea Party because the Tea Party is a fundamentally nationalist American movement, and it takes a lot of pride in our American history, which I personally am not too proud of, you know, because of its sexism, its racism. 3/5 of a black man was counted for consensus.
The Tea Party people are coming from the right place. The problem is they've been so corrupted by Republican ideology that, I mean, they vote against their own interests, you know? They vote for candidates who have absolutely no interest in helping them, and they're tricked into doing it. I think if we work on trying to make them see that, I have no problem with them joining us, because I think that's what needs to happen for this to really become like a revolutionary movement.
What about you? Do you think the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street should work together? Is it even possible? You can email us at ttbook.org or go to our Facebook page, where you can also see what everyone else has to say. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin Online Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Management, developing leaders with the critical skills to grow a green economy. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
You may think you had a tough time becoming a parent, but imagine being in a hardcore punk band and deciding to take the parenting plunge. For them, back in punk's heyday, everything was a sellout. A mortgage, a job, children. Here's the seminal punk rock band Black Flag, back in 1984, on fatherhood.
Family man, family man. With your glances my way, taking no chances on the new day, family man, with your life all planned, your little sandcastle built, smiling through your guilt, family man. Here I come. Here I come, family man. I come to infect. I come to rape your woman. I come to take your children into the street. I come for you, family man. Family man, with your Christmas lights already up. You're such a man when you're putting up your Christmas lights. First on the block, family man. Family man, I want to crucify you on your front door with nails from your well-stocked garage. Family man, family man, family man, Saint Dad, Father on fire, I've come to incinerate you. I've come home.
That's Black Flag, one of the bands featured in the documentary The Other F-Word. The documentary tells the stories of punks from the 80s and 90s who are now dads. The other F-word being father, of course. One of the fathers in the film is Jim Lindbergh. He's the former lead singer of the band Pennywise, famous for their punk anthem F-Authority. Anne Strainchamp spoke with Lindbergh and the director of the documentary, Andrea Nevins, about the trials and tribulations of the other F-word.
The problem was multifaceted. You know, the travel does get difficult after a while, and it seemed for a lot of bands now, because of the decline in CD sales, you're having to travel twice as much. So it's twice as hard for guys that have families at home. But I definitely understand that there are other lines of work where people have to travel a lot. I have friends who travel a lot for business. There's obviously people in the military that are gone for long periods of time. But the type of travel that bands do, it's a different city every single night. You know, so it's just tons of travel and tons of movement and stuff like that. And it got to the point where the record label, the agents, and the band members in my band, they wanted to continue to, you know, add more and more shows. And I had more and more piano recitals and soccer games and birthdays and Halloweens that I kept missing. And it was, you know, it was heartbreaking to miss those milestones. And they were just kind of piling up more and more. So I think it was a perfect storm for me in the punk rock dad lifestyle, where it just kind of, one side had to give. It was either the band or my family. And there's so many broken families in the music world. I knew I had to make the right choice.
You know, to speak to the issue of going out there and screaming F authority, a lot of the guys that we talked to were having some difficulty feeling authentic up there. And authenticity is one of the watchwords of the punk movement. And it does start to feel like a disconnect when you're up there screaming against the man and then coming home and being the man.
Right.
Being the
exactly.
man yourself.
And, yeah, exactly. And I feel stronger today probably than I did as a kid about politics and issues, because now I do have kids and I worry about their future. And you know, I read the newspaper cover to cover and listen to NPR and other other stations just to get as much information as I can. So I still feel very strongly, but there are songs that you wrote when you were 18, 19, 20 that don't have the same, they don't resonate the same way when you have a kid. And when you have a song called F Authority, but you're, you know, trying to tell your kids to eat their vegetables, it becomes kind of hypocritical, to say the least.
And then those kids are the children of a punk musician. Do they turn right around and say, yeah, well, F you too, Dad?
I've been waiting for them, because then I'm going to ground them for weeks when they do that. But
that's how hypocritical it all is. But that's the question. How can you? How could you ground your kid for saying that to you when you've been singing it at the top of your lungs to audiences for 20 years?
Because I'm their dad. And you don't talk back to me, because I'm your dad.
Oh, man.
Silent majority, raised by the system. Now it's time to rise against them. We're sick of the treason, sick of your lies. Fuck no, we won't listen. We're gonna open your eyes.
It's that message of the band that I think makes such an interesting conjunction with parenting. And there's some very practical parenting issues that then come up, like, you know, if you spent your adult life writing lyrics that we can't legally repeat on the air, what do you do when your four-year-old uses the F word at school?
You know, that's a conundrum and one that I faced. And that actually happened, where a kindergarten teacher on my very first back to school night, you know, said, oh, don't you have a song on the radio? I think I've heard it. And I tried to brush it off and say, no, you know, that's not me. And she's all, yeah, isn't it called F Authority? And I'm like, oh, yeah, well, I guess so. But, you know, I didn't write that one, and that's not about me. And, you know, let's focus on Brighton's work, not what Dad does. You
and
know,
we don't play definitely. That at home, I swear.
Yeah, it did get ridiculous.
Actually, which brings up an interesting, I mean, do you play your music at home? I mean, have your kids heard it all?
They've heard most of it. You know, we get played on the radio pretty frequently out here. And that song with the cuss word bleeped out gets played pretty regularly. So they know that's their dad. And I've had times where my youngest daughter came home from soccer practice and had a friend with her. And her friend said, my dad says that you have bad words in your songs. And like really scolded me. Like it was having like a 7-year-old scold me for my bad words. It was strange. But
and what did you say? Good,
I said, well, your dad's a jerk. but I used a 4-letter word for it. No, I didn't. But you know, it is a strange situation to be in, but I just tried to navigate it. I think every parent finds out it's just a different day. You're going to get a different challenge every day, and you just face it as it comes. And I think that's how you become a parent. You know, that's how you grow into the job.
You can take a garbage can and throw it through a car window, and someone will say, what the hell are you doing? You know, it's punk. You can do any thing you want to and just say, I'm punk.
It's just that kind of willfulness with a bit of insanity thrown in, a whole ton of you.
Going against the grain when everyone else tells you no, that's punk rock.
Punk rock was supposed to be about no responsibility, no rules, I'm gonna do things my way.
In your face.
We're at the wheel turn an hour before social distortion is gonna go on, and Betsy calls me, my wife, she goes, my water broke, I'm having a baby. And I'm just like, oh God, I don't know what to do.
You're gonna be the proud father of a little girl. I remember at that point, it was like everything went silent.
Some of the guys were like, good, you're gonna have a kid.
Having a baby changed everything.
You hear that, and it totally did. Wait, don't hit him with a stick, please. Thank you.
I was on the street from a real young age. I was headed for trouble.
Our dads weren't there, man, and so f*** you.
There's nothing really in the punk rock ethos that prepares you for being a dad.
Jim, if your younger self could see you today, would you think you've sold out?
No, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to describe that term. And I tried really, really hard with my band to walk that tightrope of getting the band heard by as many people as possible, but also doing things my own way and not, you know, giving in to certain influences. But, you know, I would hope my younger self would hear my latest album and still hear the fire and know that I still have the ideals that are there. Yes, they're probably tempered with the fact that I've got three young people to raise, but if they hear a song like The System or Living with Ghosts, you know, they know that I'm still fighting the righteous fight. So it's difficult, but I don't think I've sold out. I hope not.
And it's interesting that you use the word tempered because, I don't know, I mean, one of the things I really admire about the punk movement is that they really allow people to be authentic to themselves. And there's no one punk who's going to absolutely agree with another punk, but they honor the fact that they might have different values or different ideals, but that's okay because they're living them honestly.
Right.
And I think it's okay, given those rules, to slightly change your values or slightly mm-hmm. change your priorities. But if you're living truthfully with them, then that's punk.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, I guess what I'm really asking is, what does it mean to sell out anyway? And is there something strange about that notion, as though the choices that we make are wrong somehow if they don't adhere to some standard of purity we set for ourselves earlier in our lives?
Well, for me, it's always meant selling out means doing things just so you become more popular and famous and, you know, or like doing the big Ford Coca-Cola ad and
just to make money.
But, you know, it is a double-edged sword. I put a lot of thought into this because here's a really good example. Like, let's say a huge corporation offers you $1 million to let us use your song in the new commercial. And you say, no, I'm not going to do that. That's horrible. And, you know, that goes against my morals. Okay. But what if your dad worked for minimum wage his whole life or very little money and worked his butt off for you to get ahead and probably died, you know, worked himself to death his whole life for you and heard that you were offered $1 million when he worked his whole life and you're going to turn down $1 million. He'd say, you're crazy. You're no son of mine. You know, why would you do that? So there's always been a point where, like, I have that understanding of, hey, it is money. This is food on the table for the kids. And you have to have that separation of what you're willing to do and what you're not willing to do. And that was difficult because we did get offered money to be in commercials that I turned down. And there's part of me like, why are you doing that? But you have to, the only thing you have at the end is your integrity. And if you can't live with yourself, it makes it difficult to continue putting out music because you just feel so crappy about yourself. So it was difficult. I'll admit to that. But I think a lot of other dads and parents go through similar situations, you know, to how to keep that youthful ideals that you have. You know, a lot of parents were hippies and now they're yuppies.
Well, the other thing is, who better to raise a teenager than a punk rock dad? I mean, who better to deal with all the teenage issues, sex and drug use and alcohol, than somebody who's actually been there?
Yeah, I can't wait for all that.
You don't take risks and you don't gamble with your children. You can take risks for yourself. I don't think we have the right to take risks with our children.
There's one thing to be an individual. There's another thing to be an individual at the cost of the people around you.
Someone said the other day to me, man, I wish you were my father. And I go, me too. I wish I was my father too.
I know there's kids out there that might be watching this or can relate or that are from broken homes and that you clung to that anger. But you learn over time, you learn to take the anger and make it something positive. You take a negative to positive, which is going to put you on top, which is another whole type of level of a punk rock feeling of like flipping the switch.
I just felt there was a better world out there, that with a little bit of unity and cooperation, we could all make this place better. And it's very idealistic. It's a very young person's way of looking at the world. But I think once you get older, you get a little more realistic. But that's what I want to have. That's what I want to hold on to, is that feeling that we can make a change up there. And maybe the way we change the world is by raising better kids and being more attentive to those kids. And
Maybe that's how we change the world. Instead of by writing a punk rock song, maybe we just be better parents. So I want to be around for my kids. I want to be I want to be there when they want me to be there. And I think that's the punkest thing of all.
That's punk rock legend Jim Lindbergh from the documentary film The Other F Word. Andrea Nevins directed the film, and Strange Champ spoke with him. For more interviews like this, visit our new website. TTbook.org features 10 years of interviews, now available to stream, download, and share. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. The Occupy Wall Street movement that started this fall in New York has invigorated the political left. Even though the protesters were expelled from their tent city in the financial district in November, groups continue to meet daily in a public atrium at 60 Wall Street to discuss strategies for social change. But the participants are all over the political map and have wide-ranging views on what actions to take. Reporter Sarah Kate Kramer spoke with some of the activists and asked them what it would mean for Occupy Wall Street to sell out.
I would leave Occupy Wall Street if the OWS co-opted with the Democratic Party, because the Democratic Party is just as corrupt as the Republican in terms of corporate interest.
I'm not willing to compromise on things like health care for everyone and a living wage for everyone, but it depends on other things.
If that's what selling out looks like, buying a lobbyist, hiring a lawyer, getting airtime, I think it's probably an effective way to change people's minds or at least to get exposure. I'm all for it.
It would have to be a really, really, really strong argument to convince me that engaging formally with elections is an effective use of time. Endorsements, specifically.
A lot of the really high-functioning people in this movement already have sold out because they never came with the intention of sleeping in a tent every day.
If Occupy Wall Street elected a leader, it would definitely, in my eyes, have sold out. If anything happened to shatter the principles on which we were based, which is equality and a movement of leaders, it would just not be my movement anymore.
There's nothing that they could give me in exchange for leaving Occupy Wall Street that I would actually be able to use or do anything with. This is the only thing that I can be doing right now.
You may not know who the artist Shepard Fairey is, but trust me, you know his work. In the late 1980s, his Andre the Giant Has a Posse sticker campaign went viral, adorning nearly every skateboard and record shop in America. He later added the word obey to the Andre the Giant image, and it became legendary. But it wasn't until 2008 when he turned that Andre the Giant Obey image into the iconic Barack Obama Hope poster that the artist Shepard Fairey became truly famous. But in his world, a world of skateboarding and graffiti and the hip-hop credo of keeping it real, making a poster for a U.S. presidential candidate, well, that enters sellout land. Shepard Fairey took Ann Strainchamps back to the genesis of his now infamous Andre the Giant sticker.
I was teaching a friend how to make a stencil. He wanted to learn how to do it. I was making homemade Clash t-shirts and things like that. And I was also making all the shirts for a skate shop where I worked in Providence, Rhode Island. And he wanted to learn how to make a stencil, so I flipped through the newspaper to find a picture for him to practice on and saw this image of Andre the Giant. And he said, "Why don't you do this?" And he said, "No, that's stupid. I'm not doing it." And as an inside joke, I just made this stencil of it and wrote Andre the Giant Has a Posse, 7 feet four, 520 pounds on it. And it was very nonsensical. It was sort of, I called it absurdist propaganda. But it began with that. But quickly, because Andre was someone who I think to certain people was seen as this gentle giant and to others was seen as very sinister. It had this Rorschach quality, the image, where each person's interpretation was a reflection of their personality. And I became really fascinated by that, how people deal with images in public space. And it evolved from the original Andre the Giant has a posse image to more of the Obey campaign, the Orwellian Big Brother's watching you cropped in image of Andre that had been streamlined and simplified to become more of a symbol.
Well, so at some point you hit it big. I mean, not just as a punk graffiti activist, but as an artist. You know, suddenly you've got museums and gallery owners calling. You've had shows at major museums around the world, which must have been both incredibly gratifying and also complicated.
I guess the progression was so gradual that, you know, for me, I never looked at it like, oh, yeah, I just hit it big. It was a very, very slow progression. And I had a strong belief that if what I was doing as an artist resonated, that eventually it would, you know, I would be able to make a living from it. And I worked as a graphic designer for a lot of years. I worked as a screen printer. I did a lot of things just to survive. But really, the first 10 years of my career, I lived in poverty. And then I started to get some gallery shows. And also, the internet became a way to sell work. And a magazine called Juxtapose gave me a nice feature. And that was sort of the lowbrow magazine that was started by the people that started Thrasher Skateboard Magazine. And all these things converged conveniently for me to all of a sudden have a career as an artist.
But in the meantime, there's this whole underground community who've accused you repeatedly of selling out. I mean, how do you respond to that? Does that make you feel angry, guilty?
No, neither. It makes me feel frustrated sometimes because I feel like some of the people that are accusing me of being a sellout don't understand that I'm advocating for them in everything that I do. I'm trying to pave the way for people that feel like what they do is not appreciated, that it has, that society doesn't get them. And so it's a little bit frustrating for me sometimes, but, you know, I look at the concept of a sellout being compromising your integrity to pander to the lowest common denominator purely for commercial purposes. I've been able to succeed despite of my unwillingness to compromise what I do, which, at least in my opinion, I mean, there are things I've had to do to survive. Some people look at commercial work I did as a graphic designer 10 years ago, and they think that it was done because my street art had created opportunities for me to exploit and cash in on. Actually, that work was done before my street art was viable at all, and it was the money that I took from those projects to continue to expand the reach of my street art. It was almost like a Robin Hood strategy. I always called it the inside-outside approach.
We should talk about your iconic image, the Obama Hope poster, which you made at the beginning of Obama's campaign, and you didn't make it for the campaign. You made it and just sort of put it out there yourself, and then they called you, is that right, and asked if they could use it?
When I made the Hope image, I made it for my audience, thinking that it would affect a few hundred people and hoping that, no pun intended, that it would possibly become something that would resonate beyond just my audience, but knowing that I could at least affect a few people who were already paying attention to what I was doing. But I had, you know, no idea that it was going to become the viral phenomenon that it did. But the Obama campaign, they were happy to see it flourishing. But they also knew that a lot of the people that were helping to disseminate it were putting it, you know, in places that weren't totally legal or putting up stickers or posters here and there. So they were happy to have this image that captured the imagination of, I think, you know, maybe more cutting edge people disseminated in a way that didn't seem attached to a more corporate campaign. So they were happy to harness that and then happy to utilize the style for stuff they were doing. But, you know, I worked very hard with a few other people to get the images out there. We made 300,000 posters and 500,000 stickers. And that was all funded by selling 1,400 posters and a few paintings that I made, all of which I then got sued for. Anyway, it was mostly me and a small group of people that were getting the image out there. But of course, it was on the internet. So people were and I had a free download on my website. People were making their own copies, and you know, numerous knockoffs too, which was great because all the knockoffs just point back to the original and the power of the original, and making Obama more established as a patriotic mainstream character was what I think the need was at that time.
Well, so recently you came out with a new poster, which is almost a slap in the face to Obama, because instead of Obama's face, it's someone in a Guy Fawkes mask. Those are the masks that people have been wearing at the Occupy protests, with that same word, hope, and a question mark. And what were you thinking when you made that poster?
In 2008, I looked at Obama as this progressive delivery vehicle for policy movement in the right direction that I wanted to see. And I believe that Obama's a great person, a high-quality human being, but I think that I feel, and a lot of people feel, let down by his lack of strong messaging, not his lack of policy change, because he's been sabotaged by the right at every turn, but that he's not advocated vocally for the people who I think put him in office and the policies that they want to see. He's started to do it more recently. I think that the Occupy movement has shifted the conversation onto topics that are very important to discuss, and Obama's been addressing them in his speeches. But no, it wasn't intended to be a slap in the face to Obama. It was intended to be really a reminder to him that grassroots activism is what helped put him in office, and grassroots activism is behind Occupy, and he ought to be as well. If not literally behind the movement, behind the changes in policy that the movement is looking for. I'm hoping that it will maybe inspire the kind of messaging from him that I'd like to see.
That's artist Shepard Fairey. His original Obama Hope poster is now in the Smithsonian National Portrait Gallery as part of the permanent collection. And Strainchamp spoke with him. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge, Chunjin Fleming. For more information on Selling Out, please go to our website at ttbook.org, where you can also stream, podcast, download, and share TT Book shows and interviews covering the past 10 years. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and Ann Strainchamps. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.